Welcome back to another episode of The Political Life. Today, we hope you are all doing well out there. Today, we come to you with a wonderful guest, another guest that was recommended to us by Marcus Mason. And Marcus is going to have to become a co-producer on this show because he makes so many recommendations and comments, which are all welcome and very helpful. And he has great ideas for guests. And today we are going to talk to Rick Wade. And Rick is the Senior Vice President of Strategic Alliances and Outreach at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And we originally reached out to Rick to the Chamber because we were curious about how businesses and their members were dealing with COVID, dealing with the pandemic, and all the ups and downs that have been going on. And we're going to do that probably in a later episode with a different person from the U.S. Chamber. And today we're going to talk to Rick about his journey into politics and ending up at the U.S. Chamber. And so, Rick, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jim, thank you. It's good to be here. And let me say something about that Marcus Mason guy. you know, I'm assuming Marcus is a great business guy, so I'm assuming he's getting some referral fees if he's bringing so many people to you. But he's a very dear friend. I'm very grateful that he got his connect. He's a great connector of all people and good people. So I'm happy to be with you.
Well, thanks for being here. And how do you know Marcus?
So Marcus and I are fraternity brothers, and there's only one fraternity, believe it or not, of all that you may hear. That's Omega Psi Phi. So if you ever hear who's the one fraternity in America, the best, that's Omega Psi Phi. But we go way back as friends and colleagues, and certainly our political journeys. So, and we've crossed paths politically many, many years ago. Washington, D.C. is very small. And I'll say Marcus is one who's in the inner circle of the community and the crowd I roll with.
And is the fraternity a good resource for networking and working together and that type of work?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in Black Greek organizations, fraternities have historically been not only service organizations, but places to network. We've seen, funny enough, so much more visibility around Black Greek organizations, what we call the Divine Nine, because our wonderful Vice President Kamala Harris is in a sorority herself. And these sororities and fraternities make up what we call the Divine Nine. These are sort of the top nine, if you will, Black Greek fraternities and sororities in our country. So Vice President Harris has given a whole lot of more visibility to the importance of Black Greek organizations in America.
And Rick, so let's go back to the beginning. Where did you grow up and what was that like?
You know, I grew up in a very small rural, what we used to call a textile town, Jim, in Lancaster, South Carolina. Geographically, we'd be sort of below Charlotte. Lancaster is now almost a suburb of Charlotte. But I grew up in a textile town, you know, back in the day, believe it or not, where, you know, it was sort of the last remnants of still legal segregation. I grew up in a segregated community, if you will. I did not attend integrated schools until middle school. My community, ironically enough, my best friends, Patrick Cockrell and James Todd, were little white boys. And we all played together because we had one commonality, that we were poor. But yet I had to be bused to school across town to an all-Black school. I remember vividly, you know, having to go upstairs to the movie to watch a movie in the movie theater. One of the most indelible impressions that was left on me as a kid was when my mom took us to the doctor's office. And on one side, there was a colored only area. And the other side was a white waiting room. And the colored side was very deprived and torn and worn. And there was a little white kid on the white side, Jim. And I went over to play with him. And I got chastised by the reception and disciplined by my mother. And so I know very well what these sort of legal barriers of segregation have meant. They left a real impression on me, but they gave me a lot of hope. My father was a forklift operator, never finished high school. My mother was a nurse's assistant because she never could become a full nurse. in a local hospital. And but those experiences and how I grew up and the way I grew up, the values of my faith, we had to always go to church on Sunday morning. My mom made me and my four brothers and one sister go to church every Sunday morning. We had to sing in the choir. I couldn't sing a lick, but we had to sing and go to Sunday school. And so the faith values and all of those good values that I learned in Lancaster have kind of made me who I am today.
Well, it's a good reminder. We read about that type of segregation, and you think it's in the history books, and here you are having lived it right here, in elementary school and part of middle school. And it's a very good reminder. Yeah. I mean, that is quite incredible. Now, your dad, you said he served in the military, and then your four brothers also served?
Yeah, my father served in the Korean War, I have four brothers, one deceased now, but they all follow his footsteps and went into the Army. You know, back then, Jim, the Army and the military was, a tremendous pathway to success for so many Black men. There kind of weren't a lot of options, especially when you were, didn't have parents who went to college. You didn't have a ladder, a pipeline, a ladder to climb of examples. But for my brothers, and in particular, the U.S. Army became an incredible pipeline for them to be successful. They've since retired, and one just retired from another career. But that was a very important part of my upbringing, having grown up in a military family, if you will.
And you also did a little studying. You mentioned church and singing in the choir. You studied. You went to seminary school. And did your singing improve while you were at the seminary school?
It got worse. I will come back to the singing part, man. But the values that were taught me as a child. I mean, you work hard. You're not going to get anything in life for free. And you study hard, get a good education, but fundamental to all of that was just the value of belief in God. That is the core part of my whole DNA. And I've always felt this calling that was rooted in my faith to serve. And, years later in my life, I did go to seminary, to the Interdenominational Theological Center in Atlanta, which is actually the largest seminary of Black preachers in America, and ultimately ended up at Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. And at one point in my career, I actually was on a path to be an ordained minister in the United Methodist Church. And God has a way of redirecting. And I think the redirect say, no, that's not quite you yet, but let's keep learning. But it was a wonderful opportunity to study. I studied actually the philosophy of theology. I love to learn. I do believe that those kinds of teachings cut to the core of who we are as human beings and help us understand this connectivity that we have that has nothing to do with politics and nothing to do with race and gender or anything like that. But it's about our humanity. And I learned a lot from that experience being in seminary.
So faith and hard work. Your parents were obviously also hard workers.
Oh, yeah. You had no choice. I remember my mother leaving in the morning and sometimes having to work double shifts. That was hard work.
And why is that hard for you to talk about today?
I don't know if we appreciate the work ethic of people, particularly who worked out of necessity. So she did. She would leave in the morning, and then she sometimes would come home at midnight. Not because of choice, but it was really about that, she's providing for a family of eight. And my father, who was a forklift operator, but also watched the what he had to deal with as a black man in his that part of society in our lives. I mean, it was humiliating, you know. And I honestly, I'm talking from experience, but you know, and I say back then because it seemed like such a distant past that it was always hard for him to kind of look a white man in the eye, and that was humiliating for him. And so many men, and particularly black men in that era, you know, you turn outward to deal with that pain, and he turned to alcoholism. And that was an unfortunate part of life that I witnessed in my childhood. But nonetheless, through all of that, they worked incredibly hard. I mean, he worked in the cotton mill, is what we called it. And so many of my other uncles and relatives that since have passed, I mean, they worked incredibly hard. And that work ethic, certainly I've tried to emulate in my entire life and career. But there's nowhere in the world I would ever say that I've ever had to work as hard as they did for the income that they earned and for the work that they were trying to do to build their families and still maintain the dignity of being black in the Deep South in the 1960s. And so I get emotional because I think back about where I've come from and what they accomplished. And there's no reason for me to accomplish more than they ever dreamed of. And I've sought really, really hard to live out what the work that they never had an opportunity to live out, to have the experiences that they dreamed about, but they couldn't have themselves. So it's hard not to be emotional about that because it's part of my humanity and part of my DNA.
Well, and not to make you relive too much of it, but when you say had a hard time looking a white man in the eye, what does that mean?
Well, for that era in our history, I mean, that's what a lot of black men were taught. I mean, you know, that was part of sort of the culture of the Deep South in particular. I mean, it dates back to slavery. You know, don't look me in the eye. I mean, it's just sort of, you're not my peer. You're not my equal. You can't look me in the eye. I mean, that's no secret. That's just how the culture was, particularly in the Deep South. And I just remember when, back then we would call it, whether it was the insurance man or there was an older white guy who used to had a vegetable truck. His name was Carson D. He would drive and sell fresh vegetables into poor black neighborhoods. And, you know, it was just this whole spirit and tone and tenor of the South that, you know, you're here to buy from me. You're here to serve me. You're not my equal. And you could feel that energy. You could just feel it. And that unfortunately, you know, we don't deal with that today, but it is, it's a remnant of our history of who we were and how we lived and how we worked and played. And it was our culture. But I watched that and I didn't quite understand it until later on in my life when dad, before he passed, we sit down and had those conversations. And he would say, you know, I don't think you kids understand the burden that I had to carry. But I remember it, Jim, very vividly, growing up in that in the household, seeing that.
Well, and impossible to forget, you know, which is, you look at how much things have changed legally today with everything that has happened from, 1965 on. Those remnants of what you experienced and what your family experienced is, still part of who you are, still part, as you said, your DNA.
Well, that's right. And I never seek to forget it. You forgive, I don't want to forget my past. On the other hand, I don't want my past to define my future, right? So that's the context in which I look at my experience.
Well, that was my next comment or question. It's how do you, Rick, it's amazing how, you have so much positive energy and such a, we're not on video, but when we're talking before the interview, such a great smile and talking about different people, And how do you maintain such a that type of outlook? How do you not fall victim to being angry all the time?
But Jim, this is where I go back to it, the only place that I could find that I can draw, I guess, from to give an answer is my faith. That's it. And so, it's the hope of what can be. It's not what is. I mean, it's what you can become. It is drawing from those faith values, man. That I can overcome these obstacles despite the realities of my everyday circumstances. So that's what I draw from. I really do. And but for that, I would have turned outward to those other things like my dad did and given up. But I look back at some of my peers who I grew up with, and sadly enough, for me having, I guess, accomplished some modicum of success, so many were left behind. I mean, probably, of my 10 friends, I mean, I can't say that they all achieved their God-given gifts and talents because they were left behind, or the barriers that they were confronted with, they couldn't overcome them. But I kept plowing forward. I mean, I knew that there was a, as we would sing in church, a better day a coming, right? And if I could just hold on, that's what drives me. And it still drives me today. I mean, listen, I mean, we'll talk, I imagine, about where we are now, but, these challenges are still real. And, I'm still driven by the same faith and values that developed me back then and that has contributed so much to my success.
So you're, unlike your four brothers, you went to college.
Yes.
And where'd you go to college?
So I started at the University of South Carolina. And let me tell you parenthetically how I got there. I mean, the University of South Carolina is, if you've ever been to South Carolina, it's like the flagship school. But remember, I was first generation, didn't really know anything about college. But in high school, I knew I wanted to go to college. And I remember my white guidance counselor telling me the only college I could go to was the University of South Carolina. And I told her I want to go to Harvard. At least I had heard about Harvard. And she said, no, I think you'd be better off going to the University of South Carolina. And that's how I ended up at the University of South Carolina. I didn't have the mentors, even though there were amazing, accomplished leaders in my community. One in particular, a local dentist, Dr. Doug Rucker, who literally took me under his wings. And in fact, he bought me my first car when I was in college. And so there were school teachers, who black and white, who took me under their wings. But that's as much as I knew. But I didn't have sort of that generational mentor as did some of my friends whose parents had gone to college or had gone to Morehouse or Howard to say, oh, you should be a legacy and follow my footsteps. But that's how I ended up at the University of South Carolina. And clearly, I proved my guidance counselor wrong, because I ultimately did end up at Harvard University also.
I saw that. Yes.
In USC, let me be clear, the University of South Carolina was an amazing, sometimes thing works out in ways you can't imagine, but that was such an important part of my life experience. I was a student leader there. It was where I first met one of the first presidents I ever met in the United States, Ronald Reagan, who had come to the University of South Carolina for an event. And I happened to be a student intern at the university and had the pleasure of being in a room. And that matters. Because that was about being exposed to new possibilities and dreams of who I could become and where I could go. So the University of South Carolina, really, because I took advantage of every opportunity to be involved, not just in the classroom, but outside the classroom. I was a page at the Capitol and just did so much there. So it opened up my ideas and new possibilities and relationships that contributed so much to my success.
What was your impression as a student of President Reagan?
Well, listen, you remember where I just came from. I mean, and now here I'm in Columbia, South Carolina, the big city, and on the university campus. And here, in an event, a ballroom event with the President of the United States. And it was mesmerizing. I mean, just to be in the space, nothing to do with the politics at the time, who's a Republican and who's a Democrat. But that was extremely inspiring. I mean, I remember his speech, how great of an orator he was. And it was just inspiring. I mean, again, I could disagree all day and I don't think my politics were as informed at that time. But it was inspiration that mattered to me to be in that space.
And were you a page at the state capitol or in Washington, D.C.?
I was a page at the state capitol in the House of Representatives. And there's another good example of how the academic and experience of the university matters so much to me. Not only was I a page, but back then they had what's called the South Carolina Student Legislature, Jim. It was like this mock legislature, and universities elect mock House members and senators, and you convene at the Capitol. And I got elected governor. Ultimately I became the first governor and the first Black governor of the South Carolina Student Legislature. But those were the kind of experiences. And then ultimately later in life, you know, I had the fortune and the pleasure of working in the House of Representatives for the Ways and Means Committee. And ultimately the first Black chief of staff for a constitutional officer for the lieutenant governor, Nick Theodore, who I just had sort of a reunion with just about 2 or 3 months ago. So, but all of that came from that wonderful experience at the university.
And so what was the first job that you did after college?
the first job that offered me a salary.
And what was that?
Believe it or not, it had nothing to do with the experiences I just talked about. I was an admissions officer. Figure that out. So, but there was a job open in the admissions office at the university, and they reached into me. Are you interested? And I think I knew somebody there. But here's you can't. There's no science to, I guess, no plan or science to my whole career trajectory. But one of the fun things about working in the admissions office, I had never left South Carolina, right? Lancaster to Columbia University, and then I worked in the admissions office. But Jim, of all of my assignments, guess what happened? They say, well, Rick, you know, one of our largest feeder state for out-of-state students is New York and New Jersey, New York and New Jersey. So your territory will be New York and New Jersey. So back then, admissions officers, we had technology. So they gave me a station wagon with a whole lot of boxes and brochures. And there I'm all driving to New York. So I spent a lot of time on Long Island, New York, and in New Jersey recruiting students, going to college fairs. Why was that so important? And kind of because here again, I got exposed to a whole different part of our country and just met amazing people. It got to a point where, you know, families would invite me into their homes for dinner. From these college fairs. And I finally realized, you know, I would be in a big college fair hall and you had all of these universities and all the kids would flock to my booth. And back then it was when we had a good Gamecock football team. So they were all enamored about sports. But here's what else, I kind of figured out what else they were enamored by when I asked them, a student, why are you here? We just want to hear you talk. I had a really, really big Southern drawl and accent. So it was really a lot of fun. But the kids wanted to hear me talk. They said, say something. But there again was how I turned that admissions office job into an amazing exploratory opportunity to learn about, you know, other parts of our country and people.
And then from there, you went to help the work with the director of state government community relations at the school, right?
Yeah. Yes.
And is that how you dipped your toe in government relations?
That's exactly right. I was recruited to the president's office at the university and helped to lead their lobbying and community outreach office.
And how did you end up in Washington, D.C., and how did you get hooked up with President Obama?
So, yeah. So let's fast forward several years. I mentioned that after the university government relations, I got recruited by the lieutenant governor, became his chief of staff. He ultimately ran for governor several years later, unsuccessful. But during that time with him, I met this executive from a company called Hoffman LaRoche, a major pharmaceutical company that had located a big plant in South Carolina. The lieutenant governor had lost, so I needed a job. So I called Pat Zinner, who was the CEO. I said, this is Rick Wade. I met you, the lieutenant governor. I need a job. And he says, well, the timing couldn't be better. We're looking to expand our government affairs team. So I actually went to work for Hoffman LaRoche, moved to Atlanta, and ran their entire state government affairs operation. So I did that for a few years. And that actually is when I decided to go back to college, to Harvard, and where I got my master's in public administration. Roche was kind enough to kind of give me a leave, and they brought me into their Washington, D.C. office. So I did federal government affairs for Hoffman LaRoche, and I was very happy where I was. Got a call one day back in 1999 from a guy named Jim Hodges, who I grew up with literally back in Lancaster. He had just won the office of governor. And he says, Rick, you got to come back. So I actually went back to South Carolina as a member of the cabinet of the governor of South Carolina and ran what we call the Department of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Services, agency that provided treatment services to citizens across South Carolina. Parenthetically, remember now, I had a father who grew up, suffered alcoholism. What a wonderful opportunity for me to lead now an agency that provided the services that he needed back to the people of South Carolina. So I did that for a couple of years. He ran for re-election. Then I decided to run for office. I actually ran in 2002 for statewide office for Secretary of State. South Carolina had not elected an African-American statewide office since Reconstruction. So I ran for Secretary of State and came close, but didn't quite win. It was a wonderful experience in electoral politics. Lost, needed a job. And the president of Blue Cross Blue Shield called me and we saw your race. We saw you. I imagine you need a job, young man. And so he recruited me and I served a few years at Blue Cross Blue Shield. And anyway, I'm working at Blue Cross. We're now in 2003. I was there to 2007 in South Carolina, Jim. And I'm going to ask you a question right now. I'm sitting at my desk. And the phone rings and it says, I'm trying to reach Rick Wade. Well, this is Rick Wade. Well, this is Barack Obama. I said, yeah, right. I did use some other expletives because I thought it was a fraternity brother like Marcus Mason, but it wasn't. And I started listening closely and then I'm like, oh, expletive.
This is either a really good imitation or this is actually Barack Obama.
Right. So that's how we met. And you know, he and I talked and obviously he was at that time starting to give real consideration to run for president. I told him that, listen, I'll be in Washington soon. And we arranged a meeting. We met in his office in Washington, D.C. And that's how we started our relationship. There's another gentleman. If you remember back in 07, the lineup was tremendous. There was Joe Biden. There was Hillary Clinton. There was Chris Dodd. There were like six or seven people. So I actually had gotten to know Joe Biden as well, Senator Biden, during that time. He had been sort of wooing me for his support. And it was just a wonderful time. And it's where I began my journey with not only President Obama, but Joe Biden and Mark Warner. I had hosted a fundraiser at my home in South Carolina for Senator Warner before going on board with Barack Obama. So it was just an interesting time. And that changed obviously the whole course of my future.
And how, well, first of all, I love the fact that when you were, done, you know, that you called up the, back in South Carolina, when you're done being just and said, look, I need a job. I met you. You seem like a nice guy. I love that. That's great. So you met, President Obama very early on in that process, kind of before he started to take off and before not only he became the nominee, but then became, you know, that kind of the huge star that he became and everything else after that. What was it like watching that transformation from being sitting in his office and being just a senator, which is a big deal, to becoming the nominee of the Democratic Party?
It was extraordinary. And I reference one thing and part of our conversation that really was a turning point for me in terms of one deciding that I was going to support and be with him on this journey. But we were talking and he was sharing with me his vision for America, and what ultimately came his vision for hope and change. And but there was something that I'll never forget that he said, and this may sound a little trivial and simple, but you got to remember my life story, where I come from. And here's a black man who's running for president. But he said, Rick, when I become president, here's what will happen. Now, if you didn't catch that, it wasn't if. He said, when? And for some reason, that sort of resonated with me in a really profound way because of his confidence. And that really became, quite honestly, it wasn't about the issues. And certainly I was inspired that he was a Black American running and what all that meant and what a wonderful chance for me. But there was something about the confidence, because as I mentioned earlier, that's the confidence that I've tried to exude through my entire life. And that was my decision point. And ultimately, I actually resigned from Blue Cross Blue Shield. And I'm like, if I'm in all the way in. And so I left Blue Cross and became an early part of the team as an architect of not only his South Carolina strategy, but with the national campaign. I told him if I was in, I didn't want to just do the primary in South Carolina. I wanted to ride the train all the way to the White House. And that we did.
And then you served on the presidential transition team. And what was it like two questions. What was it like on election night? And what was it like when he was inaugurated? What did election that feel night, like?
Yeah. Oh, wow. Election night was phenomenal. I'll never forget it. We're all in the big park in Chicago. And I know exactly what I was doing when the race was called. I was actually in a live interview with the president of BET, Black Entertainment Television, Debbie Lee, when they called the election. And I never get this, because it was like there was so much like applause and joy and excitement, and Debbie started crying. And I actually couldn't shed a tear. I mean, I think I was like, did this just happen? Right. And probably a little numb from all the work, but that's where I was that evening, and had the pleasure of greeting him afterwards, the election. But it was a magical moment, needless to say, on election night. And I mean, it took me some time to sort of process that all of the work that we put in it, and certainly that I was honored to have been a part of that. Right. And, you know, inauguration was no different. It was glorious. It was just magnanimous. It was inspiring. And I had the worst hangover the next day. That's when the time that I was ever late for work. We didn't have a commerce secretary at the time. I don't know if you remember that. And so I had been asked to go hold the fort down at commerce, which was a great, like amazing, honorable role to be the first one to show up on day one on behalf of President-elect Obama. And I was late, Jim, so I have to admit that. And I blame it on all the inaugural parties the day before, the night before.
Oh, that is great. But Rick, what did it, where were you when he was sworn, when he put his hand on the Bible and he was sworn in, where were you standing, and what did that feel like as a African-American from South Carolina?
I was right there in the bowl. You know, we call it the bowl.
Yep.
I was fortunate enough to weave my way in.
No surprise
exactly
there.
Right.
No surprise. And where was Marcus? Marcus had to be further back, right?
You're gonna have to ask Marcus about that, but I know that. But I had the honor. I literally was in the bowl right there, sitting, yep. You know, to the left flank of the podium. But also had a wonderful opportunity. I was kind of the escort for Martin Luther King Jr.'s family, who I became very close to, Martin III and his other daughters. And his sister. And so I was sort of their host. And that was very, very, very special to me personally to kind of, and I remember behind the scenes as we were all, you know, getting staged up and going up to Capitol Hill, having to greet and spend a couple of minutes with Aretha Franklin. And it was just magical. I don't even know what to say it. And with the pride, the confidence to be able to walk out on that stage before the inauguration and just stand there and look across the National Mall. There's a little black kid.
To see him sworn in was just, it's left you speechless. Hard to believe.
Well, I had to look back at Rick from where I come from. I mean, truly, I mean, people say this phrase that, you know, you come from the outhouse to the White House. That was true for me. I mean, literally growing up poor in South Carolina, we literally had an outhouse. And I know what you, I think you know what I mean. We didn't have anything.
Yeah.
Here I am standing here at this inauguration, and we made it, and I say we because I was a part of that, to the White House. That to this day is another thing that I get emotional about. I mean, I can't help it. I mean, that it just speaks to the possibilities in America still, regardless of where we are. And I'm a living testimony, Jim. I just am. And I'm very grateful for the journey and experience. And it really did represent, you know, those two words that Barack ran on. You know, you can disagree with whatever you will about him, but when you think about hope and change, I mean, that was a journey of hope and change for me. And from that, man, I look back where I am today and how that being with him and that Commerce Department, how that changed and created a whole different course for me in my life. So all of these intervals, and that was a very special one for me, not just in my career, but it as a part of my life journey. But let me say one thing about the Department of Commerce, me and a big part of my life and ultimately my career and the way I look at the world, and I mean the world literally. One of the first things I had to do when I was at Department of Commerce, literally within a month or two, I said, Mr. Wade, you're the highest ranking official here. You have to lead a trade mission to India. And I'm like, India? I've not really been further past New Jersey. I mean that in jest, but I really had not traveled globally. I mean, much beyond the Caribbean, but that changed me again, Jim. I mean, I did lead that trade mission and had a wonderful opportunity to travel to Mumbai and Chennai and New Delhi and to do a speech at the embassy there and led this delegation of about, I guess, I don't remember, maybe 20, 30, 40 businesses on this mission. But I remember standing there as I was giving my speech at the embassy in India, and I didn't just talk about, you know, global market in India and international trade, but also talked about the kindred history and spirit between Mahatma Gandhi and Dr. King, and how Dr. King drew from the lessons of Gandhi. And, you know, so that was a little bit me of bringing my philosophy and theology into this thing, right? But from there, Jim, honestly, I mean, I was a member of the Joint Commission on Commerce and Trade with China and led trade missions all around the world. But for me personally, that then opened me up to the world, and I could see the world. I could see people through the lenses of those who live in the most impoverished slums of India, but also through some of the most accomplished business leaders and other leaders around the world. And that shaped me a lot and it helped me change and helped me better understand humanity from a global sense. But yes, I stayed at the Commerce Department a couple of years, and I left and started my own firm. And one of the firms I created was a consultancy advising foreign investors on investing and navigating the United States. I had an early on opportunity to learn from a former governor, Terry McAuliffe, who is also an entrepreneur himself, as he was looking to do a startup in electric automobiles. And then now I'm at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. It wasn't part of the plan, but it's been a great, great next stopping place along the way.
And was the Commerce Department your, was that probably, I don't want to say the best job, but one of the most exciting jobs that you've had in your career?
No question in my mind.
Yeah.
And you know, in anybody who's worked on a presidential campaign, and you know, that was a campaign that I've been like literally upfront and personal and from day one. But you know, yeah, I mean, nobody would say that they didn't want to work in the West Wing. I mean, who wouldn't say that, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, but then you realize the West Wing is smaller probably than your garage, right?
Yeah. Yep.
But I never, quite frankly, thought that that wasn't on my list to go work at Commerce Department, but it did. I mean, it was probably one of the best jobs I've had. To represent U.S. business and industry around the world and to learn about all of these issues that affect our economy. People don't know that Department of Commerce is like a holding company. They're like 11 different agencies, from the Census Bureau to the Economic Development Administration, the Minority Business Agency, International Trade Administration, Export Import Controls. There's so much there. And I learned so much from the Commerce Department experience.
President Obama, is he as pretty much what you see is what you get? He's as calm under pressure as he in reality as he seems to be? And is that what he's like in private moments?
I think I think, as I started out saying, I mean, the confidence that it takes.
Yeah.
Just to run, but to win.
When I'm president.
Right. And then and being the leader of the free world. I mean, that's nothing to sneeze at, man. I mean, so, but I think it's all of that and more. I mean, I learned a lot from President Obama. And we had our own sort of reunion.
You stay in touch with the president and the first lady?
Well, he and I had kind of a bit of our own reunion a few years ago, and it was just as magical then as it was when we started the journey back in 07.
Well, Rick, it has been so great having you on, such a great lesson and reminder, the history of our country and the journey that you have been on, and also just a great testament, all that you've been through and that your parents went through and your family, just how optimistic you are and how you talk about, how we can still be, that better country and that better idea. It's really for someone to say that who has, been through what you've been through is, inspirational.
Well, listen, simply put, it is still a place of dreams where they do come true. And I really believe that. I'm a living witness and a testament to it. And I, even at the U.S. Chamber, Jim, that's what I do every day. And I love about my job here, that I can help create pathways to help people reach their dreams. And that's very important to me.
Well, Rick, thank you very much. We really appreciate having you on. And for our listeners out there, we hope you stay safe during these trying times and have a good week. And we will see you all next Monday.